Okay, quiet, please. Just make you aware of the fact that there is also a little article that was just published by the Mises Institute that I wrote recently that has nothing to do with what I want to talk about today. Just make you aware of it. A German translation done by Robert Grützinger has also just appeared in a German monthly, Eigentümlich Frei. As the host of this conference, I take the liberty of bothering for an entire hour. Actually, my paper is significantly longer, so this is already a drastically shortened version. And it will be a little bit of a programmatic speech. So let me begin with a few remarks on libertarianism as a pure deductive theory. If there were no scarcity in the world, human conflicts would be impossible. Interpersonal conflicts are always and everywhere conflicts concerning scarce objects, scarce things. I want to do X with a certain thing, and you want to do Y with a certain thing, and that must lead to conflict. And because of such conflicts, we seek out norms of behavior with the very purpose of avoiding conflicts. If we did not want to avoid conflicts, the search for norms of conduct would be obviously senseless. We would simply fight and struggle. Absent now a perfect harmony of all interests, conflicts regarding scarce resources can only be avoided if all scarce resources are assigned as private exclusive property to some specified individual or individuals. That is logically so. But who owns what scarce resource as his private property and who does not? Now first, each person owns his physical body that only he and no one else can control directly. Only I can lift up my arm. You can lift up my arm only indirectly by first using your physical body. So each person owns his physical body because only he can control it directly. And you own your body because only you can control it directly and everybody can control your bodies only indirectly. Otherwise, if body ownership were assigned to some indirect body controller, conflict would become unavoidable as a direct body controller cannot give up his direct control over his body as long as he is alive. And second, as far as scarce resources are concerned, that can be controlled only indirectly, namely by our own nature-given and unappropriated body, that is, exclusive control over property is acquired by and assigned to that person who appropriated the resource in question first, or who acquired it through a voluntary, conflict-free exchange from its previous owner. For only the first person, the first appropriator of a resource, and all later owners connected to him through a chain of voluntary exchanges can possibly acquire and gain control over this resource without a conflict, that is, peacefully. Otherwise, if exclusive control is assigned instead to latecomers, conflict is not avoided, but contrary to the very purpose of norms, conflict is made unavoidable. Now, let me emphasize that I consider this theory essentially irrefutable, as a priori true. In my estimation, this theory, which I'm only indicated now, of course, this theory represents one of the greatest, if not the greatest, achievement of social thought. It formulates and codifies the immutable ground rules for all people everywhere who wish to live together in peace. And yet, this theory, of course, does not tell us very much about real life. To be sure, it tells us that all actual societies, insofar as they are characterized by peaceful relations, adhere, whether consciously or unconsciously, to these rules. But it does not tell us anything about to what extent this is the case. And for this, every libertarian theorist must, of course, also turn his attention to the actions of real people and become some sort of sociologist. And this brings me to the topic of left and right. The difference between the right and the left, and here I use a definition that Paul Gottfried has frequently presented, the difference between left and right is a fundamental disagreement concerning an empirical question. The right recognizes, as a matter of fact, the existence of individual human differences and diversities and accepts them as natural, whereas the left denies the existence of such differences and diversities or tries to explain these differences and diversities away and in any case regards them as something unnatural that must be rectified to establish a natural state of human equality. The right recognizes the existence of individual human differences not just with regard to the physical location and makeup of the human environment and the individual human body. More importantly, the right also recognizes the existence of differences in the mental makeup of people. That is, in their cognitive abilities, in their talents, in their psychological dispositions and motivations. The right recognizes that these mental differences resulting from the interaction of the physical environment and the physical human body are the result of both environmental and physiological and biological factors. Moreover, the right not merely recognizes the existence of these differences and diversities, it realizes also that the outcome of input differences will again be different. And it accepts these different outcomes of different inputs as normal and natural. The left, on the other hand, is convinced of the fundamental equality of men, that all men are created equal. It does not deny the patently obvious, of course, that there are environmental and physiological differences. That is, that some people live in the mountains and others on the seaside, or that some men are tall and others short, some white and others black, some male and others female. But the left does deny the existence of mental differences, or insofar as these are too apparent to be entirely denied, it tries to explain them away as somehow accidental. That is, the left either explains such differences as solely environmentally determined, or else, in those cases where it cannot be denied that biological factors do play a causal role in determining success or failure, the left considers these differences as pure luck and the resulting outcome of individual success or failure as undeserved, and in any case, whether caused by advantageous or disadvantageous environmental circumstances or biological attributes, all observable individual human differences are to be equalized somehow. And where this cannot be done literally, the left insists that the undeservedly lucky must somehow compensate the unlucky so that every person will be accorded an equal station in life in correspondence with what they think is the natural equality of all men. Now, with this short characterization of the right and the left, I return to the subject of libertarianism. Is libertarianism compatible with the worldview of the right? And is libertarianism compatible with leftist views? Now, as for the right, the answer seems to be an emphatic yes. Every libertarian only vaguely familiar with social reality will have no difficulty whatsoever acknowledging the fundamental truths of the rightist worldview. He can, and in light of the empirical evidence, indeed, he must agree with the right's empirical claim regarding the fundamental, not only physical, but also mental inequality of men. And he can, in particular, also agree with the right's normative claim of laissez-faire, that is, that this natural human inequality will inevitably result also in unequal outcomes, and that nothing can or should be done about this. There's only one important caveat, however. While the right may accept all human inequalities, whether of starting points or of outcomes as natural, the libertarian would insist that only those inequalities are natural and should not be interfered with, that have come into existence by following the ground rules of peaceful human interaction that I mentioned at the beginning. Inequalities, however, that are the result of violations of these rules do require corrective action and should be eliminated. The required corrective action, however, is not motivated by any kind of egalitarianism, but by the desire for restitution. He, and only he, who can show that he has been robbed, defrauded, or legally disadvantaged, should be made whole again by those, and only by those, who have committed these crimes against him and his property, including also cases where restitution would result in at an even greater inequality, as when a poor man had defrauded and owed restitution to a rich one. On the other hand, as for the left, the answer seems to be an equally emphatic no. The empirical claim of the left that there exist no significant mental differences between individuals and, by implication, between various groups of people, and what appear to be such differences are due solely to environmental factors and would disappear if only the environment were equalized, is contradicted by all everyday experience and mountains of empirical research. Men are not and cannot be made equal. However, it is in particular the implied normative claim and activist agenda of the left that makes it incompatible with libertarianism. The leftist goal of equalizing everyone or equalizing everyone's station in life is incompatible with private property, whether in one's own body or in external things. Instead of peaceful cooperation, it brings about unending conflict and leads to undecidedly unegalitarian establishment of a permanent ruling class lording it over the rest of us as their material to be equalized. There exist countless individual human differences, and there exist even more differences between different groups of individuals, since each individual can be fit into countless different groups. It is the power elite that determines which of these differences, whether of individuals or of groups, is to count as advantageous and lucky, or disadvantageous and unlucky, or as completely irrelevant. It is the power elite that determines how, out of countless possible ways, to actually do the equalizing of the lucky and the unlucky, That is, what and how much to take from the lucky and give to the unlucky to achieve equality. And whatever equalization is then achieved, since countless new differences and inequalities are constantly re-emerging, the equalizing job of the power elite can never ever come to a natural end, but must instead go on forever, endlessly. The egalitarian worldview of the left is not only incompatible with libertarianism, however, it is so out of touch with reality that one must wonder how anyone can take it seriously. At least for a libertarian, the answer should be obvious. The egalitarian doctrine achieved this status not because it is true, but because it provides the perfect intellectual cover for the drive toward totalitarian social control by the ruling elite. The ruling elite therefore enlisted the help of the intelligentsia, or the chattering class, and it was put on the payroll or otherwise subsidized, and in return it delivered the desired egalitarian message, which of course the intelligentsia knows to be wrong, yet which is enormously beneficial to their own employment prospects. And so the most enthusiastic proponents of the egalitarian nonsense can be found among the intellectual class. Given then that libertarianism and the egalitarianism professed by the left are obviously incompatible, it must come as a surprise that many who call themselves libertarians today are and consider themselves to be part of the left. How is such a thing possible? Now, what ideologically unites these left libertarians, who refer themselves as left libertarians, is their active promotion of various anti-discrimination policies and their advocacy of a policy of free, non-discriminatory immigration. But how is it possible to reconcile this anti-discrimination stand with private property, which all libertarians are supposed to regard as the very cornerstone of their philosophy, and which, after all, means exclusive property and hence logically implies discrimination? The short answer is by placing all current private property and its distribution among distinct people under moral suspicion. With this claim, the left libertarians fall, so to speak, in the opposite error from that committed by the non-libertarian right. As indicated, the non-libertarian right commits the error of regarding all, or at least almost all, current property holdings, including in particular also the property holdings of the state, as natural and just. In distinct opposition to this, a libertarian, as I mentioned before, would recognize and insist that some present property holdings and all or at least most state holdings are demonstrably unnatural and unjust, and as such require restitution or compensation. In reverse, the left libertarians claim that not only all or most state holdings are unnatural and unjust, and from that admission, of course, they derive their title to be libertarians, but they also insist or claim that all or most private property holdings are natural and unjust, or at least under moral suspicion. And in support of this claim, they point to the fact that all current private property holdings and their distribution among various groups of people have been affected, altered, distorted, and so forth by prior state action and legislation, and that everything would be different and no one would be in the exact same position and place he currently is had it not been for such prior state interference. Now, without any doubt, this observation is of course correct. But from this indisputable fact, it does not follow that all or most current property holdings are morally suspect and in need of any rectification. To be sure, state property must be restituted because it has been unjustly acquired. However, I will not concern myself in this speech with this particular subject, how the privatization of state property should occur. I've done that at other places. Rather, it is the further reaching claim that past injustices also render all or much of current private proper holdings morally suspect, which does not follow and which is certainly not true. As a matter of fact, at least for the Western world, most private holdings are likely just, irrespective of their history, unless and except in such cases in which a specific claimant can prove that they are not. And the burden of proof, is on whoever challenges the current private property as it exists. He must show that he is in possession of an older title to the property in question than its current owner, and that the current owner or its legal predecessor is somehow causally responsible and liable for the claimant's alleged dispossession. Otherwise, if a claimant cannot prove this, everything is to remain as it currently is. Now, certainly a considerable number of cases exist where this can be done and restitution or compensation is owed. But just as certainly with this burden of proof on any challenger of any current property distribution, not much mileage can be gained for any non-discriminatory egalitarian agenda. To the contrary, in the contemporary Western world, replete with affirmative action laws, more, not less, discrimination and inequalities would result if, as justice would require, everyone who in fact could provide individualized proof of victimization were actually permitted to do so by the state and bring suit and seek redress from his victimizer. But left libertarians, also sometimes referred to as bleeding heart libertarians or humanitarian cosmopolitan libertarians, are not exactly known as fighters against affirmative action. Rather, and quite to the contrary, in order to reach the conclusion that they have decided in advance that they would want to reach, they relax or dispense altogether with the requirement for someone claiming victimhood of offering individualized proof of victimization. Typically, in order to maintain their intellectual status as libertarians, the left libertarians do so quietly, surreptitiously, or even unknowingly, but in effect, in giving up this fundamental requirement of justice, they replace private property and property rights and private property rights violations with the muddled notion of civil rights and civil rights violations, and they replace individual rights with group rights and thus become, in a way, closet socialists. Relieved of the burden of individualized proof of victimhood, the left libertarians are essentially unrestricted in their discovery of new victims and victimizers in accordance with their own presupposed egalitarian assumptions. To their credit, they recognize the state as an institutional victimizer, an invader of private property rights. Again, and from this they derive their claim to be libertarians, but they see far more institutional and structural injustices and social distortions far more victims and victimizers, and far more need for restitution, compensation, and attendant property redistribution in the current world than only those injustices and distortions committed and caused by the state, and to be resolved and rectified by shrinking and ultimately dismantling and privatizing all state holdings and functions. The views held by left libertarians in this regard are not entirely uniform, but they typically differ little from those promoted by cultural Marxists. They assume as natural a largely flat or horizontal society of equals, that is, of essentially universally and worldwide homogeneous, like-minded and talented people of more or less similar social and economic status and standing, and they regard all systematic deviations from this model as a result of discrimination and grounds for some form of compensation and restitution. Accordingly, the hierarchical structure of traditional families, of sex roles, and the partition of labor between males and females is considered unnatural. Indeed, all social hierarchies and ranks, vertical rank orders of authority, of headsmen and chiefs, of patrons and nobles, aristocrats and kings, of bishops and cardinals, and of bosses in general, and of their respective underlings or subordinates, are viewed with great suspicion. Similarly, all great or excessive disparities of income and wealth, of so-called economic power, and the existence of both a downtrodden underclass as well as of an upper class of super wealthy people and families are deemed unnatural. As well, large industrial and financial corporations and conglomerates are considered artificial creatures of the state, and also suspect, unnatural, and in need of repair, according to them, are all exclusive associations, societies, congregations, churches, and clubs, and all territorial segregation, separation, and secession, whether based on class, gender, race, ethnicity, lineage, language, religion, profession, interest, custom, or tradition, whatever it is. Now, from that vantage point, the victim groups and their victimizers are easily identified. The victims are, and you know the role of them, are women, blacks, browns, Jews, homosexuals, or more generally GLBTs, not to be confused with BLT sandwiches, gypsies, foreigners, strangers, and every down and out or otherwise exotically rare human specimen or minority. Accordingly, then, of course, the victimizers are the small part of mankind that is excluded from this definition. They are white, that includes Northern Asians. When I say white in the future, obviously Northern Asians are included here. Male, Gentile, straight people associating and consorting with their likes, that is, with other men and women of similar background and conduct. And among this small minority, in particular, the most successful and wealthy ones, big industrialists, businessmen, bankers, and so forth. Now, while this view of human history strikes one as bizarre, to say the least, it coincides almost completely with the victimology also propagated by the cultural Marxists. Both groups only differ on the cause of this similarly identified, described, and deplored structural state of victimization. For the cultural Marxist, the cause is, of course, private property and unbridled capitalism. And for them, the answer how to repair the damage done is clear and easy. All necessary restitution, compensation, and redistribution are done by the state which they, of course, presumably control. Now, for the left libertarians, this answer obviously does not work. They are supposed to be in favor of private property and the privatization of state property. They cannot have the state do the restitution because the state is itself an illegitimate institution, because as libertarians, as I said, they're supposed to dismantle and ultimately abolish the state. Yet they want more restitution than only that which would result from the privatization of all so-called public, also so-called public property. But what? And on what grounds? Whenever there is individualized proof of victimization, that is, if some person A can demonstrate that another person B has invaded or taken A's property or vice versa, no problem exists. The case is clear. But absent any such proof, what else is it that the victimizers owe their victims? And on what grounds? How to determine who owes whom how much and of what? And how to implement this restitution scheme in the absence of a state and without thereby trampling on someone else's private property rights? Now, this poses the central intellectual problem for any self-described left libertarian. Not surprisingly, the answer given by them to this challenge turns out evasive and vague. From all I can gather, there's a wide literature on this, lots of people are involved in this movement. From all I can gather, it amounts to little more than an exhortation. As some keen observer of the intellectual scene has summarized it, this exhortation is, be nice. Or more precisely, you small little group of victimizers must be always be especially nice, forgiving, and inclusive vis-a-vis all members of the vast majority of victims. That is the long familiar list of everyone except white heterosexual males and so forth. And as for the enforcement of this, all victimizers not demonstrating proper respect to some victim class member, that is, victimizers who are nasty, unforgiving, or exclusive, or who say nasty or disrespectful things about them, must be publicly shunned, humiliated, and shamed into obedience. Now, at first sight, or hearing this proposal, how to do restitution may appear, well-meaning, harmless, and plain nice, because these are nice people, after all. In fact, however, it is anything but nice and harmless advice. First off, why should anyone be particularly nice to anyone else? Apart from, of course, respecting everyone's private property rights in certain specified physical means and goods. To be nice, after all, is a deliberate action and takes an effort. There are opportunity costs. The same effort could also be put to other effects. Moreover, niceness must be warranted. Why should I be nice to people who are nasty to me? Indiscriminating niceness diminishes and ultimately extinguishes the distinction between meritorious and faulty conduct. Too much niceness will be given to undeserving people, and too little will be given to deserving ones, and the overall level of nastiness will consequently grow, and public life will become increasingly unpleasant. Moreover, there are also genuinely evil people doing real evil things to real private property owners. Most importantly, of course, the ruling elites in charge of the state apparatus, as every libertarian would have to admit. Now, one surely has no obligation to be nice to them. And why is it in particular the small minority of white, Gentile, heterosexual males, and especially its most successful members, that owes some extra kindness to the vast majority of all other people? Why not the other way around? After all, most, if not all, technical inventions, machines, tools, and gadgets in current use everywhere and anywhere, on which our current living standards and comforts largely and decisively depend, originated with them. All other people, by and large, imitated what they had invented and constructed first. All others inherited the knowledge embodied in the inventor's products for free. And isn't it the typical white hierarchical family household of father, mother, their common children, and prospective heirs, and their bourgeois conduct and lifestyle, that is everything that the left despises, disparages, and maligns, isn't it that lifestyle and that social order that is the economically most successful model of social organization the world has ever seen, with the greatest accumulation of capital goods and wealth, and the highest average living standards? And isn't it only on account of the great economic achievements of this minority of victimizers that a steadily increasing number of victims could be integrated and partake in the advantages of a worldwide network of the division of labor? And isn't it only on account of the success of the traditional white bourgeois family model also that so-called alternative lifestyles could all emerge and be sustained over time? Excuse me. I will come to the apparent answer to these rhetorical questions shortly. Before, however, a second strategic error in the left libertarian advice of special niceness towards historic victims must be briefly addressed. Interestingly, the victim groups identified by both left libertarians and the cultural Marxists differ little, if at all, from the groups identified as underprivileged and in need of compensation also by the state. While this poses, of course, no problem for cultural Marxists and can be interpreted as an indicator of the extent of control that the cultural Marxists have already gained of the state apparatus, for left libertarians, this coincidence should be cause for some intellectual concern. Why would the state pursue the same or similar end of non-discrimination of victims by victimizers that they, the left libertarians, too want to achieve, if only by somewhat different means? Now, left libertarians are typically oblivious to this question, and yet, to anyone with only some common sense, the answer should be quite apparent. In order to reach total control over each individual person, the state must pursue a divide et impera policy. It must weaken, undermine, and ultimately destroy all other rival centers of social authority. Most importantly, it must weaken the traditional patriarchic, male-led family household, especially the independently wealthy family households, as autonomous decision-making centers by sowing and legislating conflicts between wives and husbands, children and parents, women and men, rich and poor. As well, all hierarchical orders and ranks of social authority, all exclusive associations, and all personal loyalties and attachments, be it to a particular family, community, ethnicity, tribe, nation, race, language, religion, custom, or tradition, whatever, all possible attachments to any of these identities, except the attachment to a given state, qua citizen, subject, and passport holder, must be weakened and ultimately destroyed. And what better way to do this than to pass anti-discrimination laws. In effect, by outlawing all discrimination based on gender, sexual orientation, age, race, religion, national origin, and so on and so on, all women, and especially, of course, single mothers and lesbians, all blacks and browns, all homosexuals, all down and out, and all foreigners, strangers, aliens, are declared state-certified victims. Anti-discrimination laws then are an official call upon all victims to find fault and complain to the state about their own favorite white, Gentile, hot, heterosexual male oppressors, and especially the more wealthy ones among them, and their oppressive machinations. That is, their sexism, their homophobia, their chauvinism, their nativism, their racism, their xenophobia, or whatever it is. And for the state to respond to such complaints then by cutting the oppressors down to size. That is, in successively dispossessing them of their property and authority and correspondingly expanding and strengthening its own monopolistic power vis-a-vis an increasingly weakened, fragmented, fractionalized, and dehomogenized society. Ironically then, and contrary to their self-proclaimed goal of wanting to shrink or even eliminate the state, the left libertarians, with their peculiar egalitarian victimology, become accomplices to the state and effectively contribute to the aggrandizement of its power. Which brings me to my final subject. The role of left libertarianism as an accomplice to the state becomes even more apparent when one considers their position on the increasingly virulent question of migration. Left libertarians are typically ardent advocates, in particular, of a policy of free and non-discriminatory immigration. But on what grounds should there be a right to unrestricted free immigration? No one has a right to move to a place that is already occupied by someone else, unless he has been invited by the present occupant. And if all places are already occupied, all migration is migration by invitation only. A right to free immigration exists only for virgin country or for open frontier. There are only two ways of trying to get around this conclusion and still rescue the notion of free immigration. The first one is to place all current place occupants and occupations under moral suspicion again. To this purpose, much is made of the fact that all current place occupations have been affected by prior state action, by war and by conquest, and so forth. But as I already explained in a slightly different context before, from this indisputable fact, it does not follow that any current place occupant has a claim to migrate to any place else, except, of course, when he owns that place or has permission from its current owner. The second possible way, the more popular possible way out among left libertarians, is to claim that all so-called public property, the property controlled by local, regional, or central governments, is akin to open frontier with free and unrestricted access. Yet this is certainly erroneous. From the fact that government property is illegitimate because it is based on prior expropriations, it does not follow that it is unowned and free for all. It has been funded through local, regional, national, or federal tax payments. And it is the payers of these taxes then, and no one else, who are the legitimate owners of all public property. In a world where all places are privately owned, the immigration problem simply does not exist. It vanishes simply. There exists no right to immigration. There exists only the right to trade, buy, or rent various places. Yet what about immigration in the real world with public property administered by local, regional, or central state governments? First, let's ask us the following question. What would immigration policies be like if the state would, as it is supposed to do, act as a trustee of taxpayer-owned public property? Or, formulated a little bit differently, what about immigration if the state acted like the manager of the community property jointly owned and funded by the members of a housing association or of a gated community? Now, at least in principle, the answer is clear. A trustee's guideline regarding immigration would be what I call the full cost principle. That is, the immigrant or his inviting resident should pay the full cost of the immigrant's use made of all public goods or facilities during his presence. The cost of the community property funded by resident taxpayers should not rise, or its quality fall, on account of the presence of immigrants. On the contrary, if possible, the presence of an immigrant should yield the resident owners a profit, either in the form of lower taxes or community fees, or a higher quality of community property, and hence all around higher property values. But then, of course, this is not what the state does. The immigration policies of the states that are confronted with the highest immigration pressure today, that is, of the United States and of the countries of Western Europe, have very little resemblance with the actions of a trustee. They do not follow the full cost principle. They do not tell the immigrant, essentially, to pay up or leave. To the contrary, they tell him, once in, you can stay and use not just all roads, but all public facilities and services for free or at discounted prices, even if you do not pay up. That is, they subsidize immigrants, or rather, they force domestic taxpayers to subsidize them. And they still further subsidize immigration, or internal migration of immigrants, at the expense of resident taxpayers in prohibiting, by means of non-discrimination laws, not only all internal, local entry restrictions, but also and increasingly all restrictions concerning the entry and use of all domestic private property. And as for the initial entry of immigrants, whether as visitors or residents, states do not discriminate on the basis of individual characteristics as a trustee would and as every private property owner would regarding his own private property, but on the grounds, on the basis of groups or classes of people, that is, based on nationality, ethnicity, and so forth. They do not apply a uniform admission standards, for instance, of checking the identity of the immigrant, of conducting some sort of credit check on him, and possibly charging him an entrance fee. Instead, they allow some classes of foreigners in for free without any visa requirements, as if they were returning residents. For instance, all Romanians and Bulgarians, irrespective of their individual characteristics, are now free to migrate to Germany or the Netherlands and stay there to make use of all public goods, facilities, and so forth, even if they do not pay up and live at German and Dutch taxpayers' expense. Similar for Puerto Ricans vis-a-vis the United States and U.S. taxpayers, and also to a certain extent for Mexicans who are effectively allowed to enter the United States illegally as uninvited and unidentified trespassers. On the other hand, other classes of foreigners are subject to painstaking visa restrictions. Thus, for instance, all Turks, again, completely irrespective of their individual characteristics, must undergo an intimidating visa procedure and may be entirely prevented from traveling to Germany or the Netherlands, even as tourists, even if they have been invited, even if they command over sufficient funds to pay for all costs associated with their presence. Now, resident owner taxpayers are thus harmed twice. Once by indiscriminating, including some classes of immigrants, even if they can't pay up and won't pay up, and on the other hand, by indiscriminating, excluding other classes of immigrants, even if they can pay up, have been invited, and all the rest of them. Left libertarians, interestingly, do not criticize this immigration policy as contrary to that of a trustee of public property, ultimately owned by the resident taxpayers, domestic taxpayers, however, that is, for not implying the full cost principle, and accordingly wrongly discriminating, but they criticize the current immigration policy for discriminating at all. Free, non-discriminatory immigration for them means that visa-free entry and permanent residency be made available to everyone, that is, to each potential immigrant on equal terms, regardless of individual characteristics or the ability to pay for the full cost of one's stay. Now, to their credit, left libertarians recognize some of the consequences of this policy, what that policy would have in the present world. Absent any other internal or local entry restrictions concerning the use of domestic public properties and services, and increasingly absent also all entry restrictions regarding the use of domestic private property, owing to the existence of non-discrimination laws, the predictable result would be a massive inflow of immigrants from third and second world countries into the United States and Western Europe, and the quick collapse of the current domestic welfare state system. Yet why would this be a desirable goal for anyone calling himself a libertarian? True enough, the tax-funded public welfare system should be eliminated root and branch. But the inevitable crisis that a free immigration policy would bring about does not produce this result. What left libertarians typically ignore in their almost nonchalant and even sympathetic appraisal of the predictable crisis is the fact that the immigrants who caused the collapse are still physically present when it occurs. For the left libertarians, this fact does not imply a problem. For them, since all people are more or less equal, and hence an increase in the number of immigrants has no more of an impact than an increase of the domestic population through higher birth rates, for instance. For every social realist, however, indeed for everyone with any common sense, this premise is patently false and potentially dangerous. A million more Nigerians or Arabs living in Germany, or a million more Mexicans or Hutus or Tutus residing in the United States, it's quite a different thing than a million more homegrown Germans or homegrown Americans. With millions of third and second world immigrants present when the crisis hits and the paychecks stop coming, it is highly unlikely that a peaceful outcome will result and a natural private property-based social order will emerge. Rather, it is far more likely and indeed almost certain that civil war, looting, vandalism, tribal and ethnic gang warfare will break out instead, and the call for a strong state will become increasingly unmistakable. One might ask then, why does the state not adopt the left libertarian immigration policy and grasp the opportunity offered by the predictable crisis to further strengthen its own power? A free immigration policy would further strengthen the tendency toward social dehomogenization, division, and fragmentation, and it would further weaken the traditional white heterosexual male-dominated social order and culture associated somehow with the West. The answer as to why not appears simple. In contrast to left libertarians, the ruling elites are still realistic enough to recognize that besides the great opportunities for state growth, the predictable crisis would also entail some incalculable risk and could lead to social upheavals of such proportions that they themselves may be swept out of power and be replaced by other foreign elites. Accordingly, the ruling elites proceed only step by step on their path toward a non-discriminatory immigration policy of non-discriminatory multiculturalism. And yet they are happy about the left libertarian free immigration propaganda because it helps the state not just to stay on its current course of divide et impera, but to proceed on it at an accelerated pace. Contrary to their own anti-status pronouncements and pretensions, then, the peculiar left libertarian victimology and its demand for undiscriminating niceness and inclusiveness vis-à-vis the long familiar list of historical victims, including in particular also all foreigners qua potential immigrants, actually turns out to be a recipe for the further growth of state power. The cultural Marxists, they know this, and that is the reason why they adopted this very same victimology. The left libertarians do apparently not know this and are thus the cultural Marxist useful idiots, in order to use Lenin's term, on their march toward totalitarian social control. Let me come to a conclusion and a return to libertarianism and the topic of left and right, and thereby finally also answer my earlier rhetorical questions concerning the peculiar leftist victimology and its true significance. You cannot be a consistent left libertarian because the left libertarian doctrine, even if unintended, promotes status that is unlibertarian ends. And from this, many libertarians have drawn the conclusion that libertarianism is neither left nor right, that it is just thin libertarianism. I do not accept this conclusion. Neither did Murray Rothbard accept this conclusion. And indeed, I consider myself a right libertarian and a consistent one at that. True enough, the libertarian doctrine is a purely deductive an a prioristic theory, and as such does not say or imply anything about the rival claims of the right and the left regarding the existence, the extent, and the causes of human inequalities. That is an empirical question. But on this question, the left happens to be largely wrong and unrealistic, whereas the right happens to be largely correct and realistic. There can be consequently nothing wrong with applying a correct a prioristic theory of how peaceful human cooperation is possible to a realistic, that is, fundamentally rightist description of the world. Realistically, a right libertarian does not only recognize that physical and mental abilities are unequally distributed among various individuals within each society, and that accordingly each society will be characterized by countless inequalities, by social stratification, and the multitude of rank orders of achievement and authority. He also recognizes that such abilities are unequally distributed among the many different societies coexisting on the globe, and that consequently also the world as a whole will be characterized by regional and local inequalities, disparities, stratification, and rank orders. He notices further that among these unequally distributed abilities, both within any given society and between different societies, it is also the mental ability of recognizing the requirements and the benefits of peaceful cooperation. And he notices that the conduct of the various regional or local states and their respective power elites that have emerged from different societies is a good indicator for the various degrees of deviations from the recognition of libertarian principles in these very societies. Moreover, more specifically, he realistically notices that libertarianism as an intellectual system was first developed and furthest elaborated in the Western world by white males in white male-dominated societies. That is, in white heterosexual male-dominated societies where adherence to libertarian principles is the greatest and the deviations from them least severe, as indicated by the comparatively less evil and extortionist state policies in those places. He recognizes that it is white heterosexual men who have demonstrated the greatest ingenuity, industry, and economic prowess. And it is societies dominated by white heterosexual males, and in particular by the most successful among them, which have produced and accumulated the greatest amount of capital goods and achieved the highest average living standards. In light of this, as a right libertarian, I would of course first say to my children and my students, always respect and do not invade others' private property rights, and recognize the state as an enemy and indeed the very antithesis of private property. But I would not leave it at that. I would not say or silently imply that once you have satisfied this requirement, anything goes, which is pretty much what thin libertarians appear to be saying. I would not be a cultural relativist, as most thin libertarians, at least implicitly, are. Instead, I would add, at a minimum, be and do whatever makes you happy. But always keep in mind that as long as you are an integral part of the worldwide division of labor, your existence and well-being depends decisively on the continued existence of others, and especially on the continued existence of white heterosexual male-dominated societies, their patriarchic or patrician family structures, and their bourgeois or aristocratic lifestyle and conduct. Hence, even if you do not want to have any part in that, recognize that you are nonetheless a beneficiary of this standard Western model of social organization, and hence, for your own sake, do nothing to undermine it, but to be supportive of it instead as something to be respected and protected. And to the long list of victims, I would say, do your own thing. Live your own black, brown, feminist, Jewish, homosexual life as long as you do it peacefully and without invading other people's private property rights. If, and insofar as you are integrated into the international division of labor, you do not owe restitution to anyone, nor does anyone owe you any restitution. Your coexistence with your supposed victimizers is mutually beneficial. But keep in mind that while the victimizers could live and do without you, albeit at a lower standard of living, the reverse is not true. The disappearance of the entire victimizer class would imperil your very own existence. Hence, even if you don't want to model yourself on the example provided by white male culture, be aware that it is only on account of the continued existence of this model that all alternative cultures can be sustained at their present living standards, and that with the disappearance of this Western model as a global effective Leitkultur, the existence of many, if not all, of your fellow victims would be endangered. This does not mean that you should be uncritical of the Western white male-dominated world. After all, even these societies most closely following the correct model also have their various states that are responsible for reprehensible acts of aggression,
not only against their own domestic property owners, but also against foreigners. But neither where you live, nor anywhere else, should the state be confused with the people. It is not the Western state, but the traditional, normal, standard Western lifestyle and conduct of Western people, already increasingly under heavy attack by their very own state rulers and their drive toward totalitarian social control. It is these people and their culture that deserve your respect and of which you are a beneficiary. That's why I would call myself a right libertarian. Thank you.